From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Rayshard Brooks was killed by police in Atlanta on June 12th. Thanks to footage from a witness's cell phone and police body and dash cameras, the public has minute-by-minute details of how it all unfolded. There's visual evidence of almost every decision the officers make. The video captures what they do. Of course, the question is, why do they do it? Now, there are no simple answers about excessive force and about policing, but this hour on Point, we want to look more carefully at one piece of that puzzle, the one that policymakers often turn to when considering reforms, and that's police training. So joining us to help us do that is Seth Stoughton. He's with us from Columbia, South Carolina. He's a law professor at the University of South Carolina and a former police officer who served in Tallahassee, Florida. He's also the co-author of the book Evaluating Police Use of Force. Seth Stoughton, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Meghna. I appreciate you having me on.
So first of all, I wonder if you could just help us break down a little bit of what is revealed in the video footage around the death of Mr. Brooks. So first of all, I'll just describe some moments here, and maybe you can just respond to them a little bit. Because first we see, for people who have seen the video, there's the officers who, as they first approach Rayshard Brooks for sleeping in his car at a Wendy's. And Brooks in the beginning, he's very friendly. He's compliant with the officers. He even offers to leave his car there at the Wendy's and walk home. And the officers don't let him do that. So can I just ask you about that early decision they make? Why would they? What is it about training that made them say, no, we're going to keep you here and continue to question you?
So that may not just be a training matter. That's also an enforcement matter. And what you're referring to here is their decision to treat Mr. Brooks to treat that interaction as an enforcement interaction. They're going to investigate to see if he had committed a crime, and you see them later run him through field sobriety exercises,
right,
as opposed to treating that as, say, a more public health matter. And saying, okay, well, if you're okay, let's make sure that we get you home and we don't endanger anyone on the roads.
Oh, well, so, can I just jump in there? Because
that was actually sure.
the next question I had. Like, do they have a choice? Because they do a breathalyzer on him. I mean, did they have the choice to not do a breathalyzer test and just let him go home?
Sure. Yeah, there is a tremendous discretion for officers to treat any particular interaction or almost any particular interaction as a potential enforcement matter, or to use their discretion and handle it in other ways. So what's really important here is not just the particular decision that officers made, but the backdrop against which they made it. And for at least 30 or 40 years, we, society, have been telling officers, you should take DUI very seriously and treat it like a crime and investigate it and make arrests. So it's not a huge surprise to me that when officers interact with someone and think, oh, this could be a DUI situation or a DWI in some states, that they're going to treat it like a potential enforcement interaction as opposed to just a check the welfare and make sure someone gets home safely.
I see.
It is a choice, but it's a choice that's informed by what we might call social expectations about what officers are supposed to do.
So right there, you're saying off the bat that the context is set for a particular approach that leads to enforcement over public health. Do we see that in other areas of policing?
Oh, tremendously, yes. And this is one of the persistent problems that's created a lot of friction, where we as society have put officers in the position of treating as enforcement matters, as criminal matters, a whole range of social issues that may be better addressed through other means. If you think about how we've criminalized homelessness and other aspects of poverty, alcoholism and substance abuse, school discipline and mental health, there's a reason that in most communities, the local jail is the single biggest either provider of or warehouser of mental health, individuals with mental health diagnoses. That's a situation that should not exist. It's not a situation that exists because of police training specifically. It's a situation that exists because of the position that we in society have put officers into.
But let's be frank here, though, because we have to ask, do we see this quick escalation or this quick decision to follow an enforcement path come because Mr. Brooks is black, right? Because I think a lot of people might ask, well, if he had been white, or any race other than black, because you're saying officers still have a lot of discretion throughout the whole interaction. Would they have just said, nah, it's all right, go home?
Yeah, it's a really important question. And the difficult part about race is I can't look at any individual encounter, any one encounter, and say, yes, this is exactly what role race played. What we can do is back out a little bit and take a look more broadly. And we know that there are racial disparities in police actions. We know that officers do stop black motorists more often. And according to a fairly recent study out of Stanford that looked at more than 100 million traffic stops, officers stop black drivers more often during the day when they can actually see the driver's race than they do at night. We know that officers ask black drivers for consent to search their car more often than they do white drivers. And if we look at drug use particularly and drug enforcement, we know that although drug use rates are very, very close between the black population and the white population within a statistical margin of error, we also know that black drug users are 6, 7, 8 times more likely to be arrested, prosecuted, convicted, and incarcerated than white drug users are. So I can't look at the interaction with Mr. Brooks and say race is definitely a factor. If we look at the body of cases, I think there is reason to suggest that race does play a role, intentional or more often, I think, unintentional, unconscious, in a number of police interactions.
So I want to ask you in a second about the series of events that happen next in the death of Rayshard Brooks. But before I get to that, I just want to remind folks that you served as a police officer in Tallahassee, Florida.
Did
you do DUI stops? I mean, just put us... Give us your personal experience about the kinds of decisions you had to make in maybe sort of analogous situations.
Yes, I did do DUI stops. I actually did a number of DUI stops and arrests. I was breathalyzer certified, so I was one of the officers who could administer the breath test using the, I believe it was the Intoxilizer 5000 machine. In Florida, DUIs are a little different. It's going to depend a little bit on state law. And in Florida, it takes quite a significant amount of time to do a DUI arrest. Often it's hours of not just investigation, but also paperwork. In other states, like in Georgia, it's much easier. It's much more straightforward. So I would say that there weren't as many officers who would do DUI enforcement, but I did take a pretty hard stance towards DUI as an officer.
Hard stance meaning what?
Meaning I was more likely as an officer to arrest someone for DUI than I was to just make sure that they got home safely, just get them a ride home. And in large part, that's because of I was very much a creature of my environment. DUI was a crime. MAD, the Mothers Against Drunk Driving organization, gave an award every year to officers who made more than 100 DUI arrests every year. It was viewed as a public health and safety issue and something that had to be addressed with the weight of the criminal justice system.
Now, we should just make it clear that in the case of Rayshard Brooks, when the officers arrived at the scene to begin with, he was in his car, but the car wasn't moving, right? They approached him originally for being asleep at the Wendy's. So, look, every situation is unique in its own details. So I appreciate your candor, Seth, and I also at the same time I don't want to draw too many lines between unrelated cases. I just want to put that out there. But we do have to talk for a minute about what happens next, right? Because the breathalyzer comes back, They make the decision to arrest him then. And maybe what you just said helps us understand why they made that decision. But as people know, again, from the video, there is a struggle that ensues. There's two officers and Mr. Brooks. They wrestle. Brooks seizes one of the tasers. Then he runs away. Okay, so he runs away. Officer Garrett Wolfe pursues him. Brooks turns and kind of wildly fires the taser up into the air. Okay. It doesn't even come close, as far as I can see in the video, to the officer. But at that moment, this is where Officer Garrett Rolfe decides to... He makes a decision. He drops his taser, picks up his firearm while he's running, and he shoots Rayshard Brooks in the back. Is there anything about how officers are trained that can help us understand that decision at that moment?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I want to go back just a second, because I'm not suggesting that the Rayshard Brooks situation was a public health and safety situation. I was saying that as an officer, that is the way that I saw it. Yeah. But I think one of the conversations we need to have is whether that's the way we should continue to see either DUI situations generally, or specifically DUI situations or potential DUI situations like the one in this case. With regard to that use of deadly force that we're focused on, officers are generally trained that when someone has taken their taser away and is attempting to use it on them, that it is a deadly force situation. And the reason for that is that the taser, if both of the prongs connect, the way the taser works is it shoots out two prongs. And if those prongs connect, they can incapacitate the target. And the concern in law enforcement is once an officer is incapacitated, they can be disarmed and their gun used against them.
Well, Seth, hold on for just a moment, because I want to dig more into that in just a second. We're talking about police training this hour. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about police training. And Seth Stoughton joins us. He's law professor at the University of South Carolina. He's also a former police officer who served in the Tallahassee, Florida Police Department, and co-author of the book Evaluating Police Uses of Force. Now, Professor Stoughton, before the break, you were telling us something very important about that moment that Garrett Rolfe shot Rayshard Brooks in the back. So that it was about how officers are trained to see what might the consequences or the implications of their own tasers being used against them. Can you tell me more about that?
Sure. So a significant amount of police training still, even today, is fear-based. It emphasizes the risks that officers face, the threats, the idea that they have to be hyper-vigilant. And one of the scariest things for an officer is the idea of being disarmed and having their own firearm used against them. When someone takes an officer's taser and uses it against them, if the taser works the way that it's designed to, it can incapacitate an officer for the 5-second activation cycle. And in that time, the fear is that the subject can disarm the officer, can take their firearm and use it against them. So as a general rule, and I want to emphasize that because I think it's important in this case particularly, officers are typically taught that if someone has taken their taser and is attempting to use it against them, that is a deadly force situation. Because if the taser is used against them and it is successful, they are not going to be able to prevent that person from taking their gun and potentially using that against them or others.
Mm. And I take your point about the general rule. In this case, so there were two officers at the scene, right? Doesn't that make a difference?
It certainly should make a difference. And not only were there two officers at the scene, but Mr. Brooks was still, at the time he fired the taser, was still running away from the officers.
Right.
So when you look at the context, to me at least, the chances, the risk of Mr. Brooks being able to double back and disarm an incapacitated officer while another officer is present seems very low. But the way that officers are trained is not always that contextual. It can be much more, if someone is using the taser on you, that's deadly force, without emphasizing the potential for contextual differences. It's also worth pointing out here that this is a situation where the officer did have to make a decision in a fairly short period of time. That's often not the case, even with use of force situations. There's this perception, particularly within policing, that every decision is made in a split second. And the whole point of good tactics and a good approach is to avoid putting officers into a position where they have to make a truly split-second decision. But sometimes their decisions are time-pressured, and this is one of them.
Right, because it was, what, a minute or so between when they just made the decision to arrest Rayshard Brooks and when he was killed, right?
Right, and in the context of that brief foot pursuit and the Mr. Brooks' use of the taser. Another point we should bring up here, though, is the officer did not use his firearm, as best as I can understand the video, the officer did not use his firearm simultaneously with Mr. Brooks using the taser. It did follow Mr. Brooks' discharge of the taser by several seconds. So that also factors in. Unfortunately, use of force situations, particularly in time-pressured situations, are complicated. There's a lot going on, and human decision-making can suffer. But one of the overarching issues that we need to look at, and I'm really glad to be part of this conversation, is whether we're providing officers with the skills, the mm-hmm. training that they need to make good decisions, even in those time-pressured environments.
So that is the heart of the question for this hour. And let me ask you, said a little bit earlier that much of police training is fear-based, right? I heard you correctly when you said that.
Yes.
Okay, so if that's the case, don't we know enough about how the human brain works that like just the human brain doesn't always make the best decisions when it's in an amplified state of fear? I mean, if the training is fear-based, are we already not setting up officers to make perhaps poor decisions even before a situation begins?
We are, yes. And I've argued in a number of different forums that fear-based training is not just unhelpful, it's actually counterproductive. It makes things worse for officers. It makes things worse for the community members they interact with. It can increase the likelihood of an officer approaching a situation in a way that generates resistance, and it can increase the likelihood that officers will use force. It is a problem. It is one of the bigger problems, I think, in police training today.
Well, we're going to come back to this issue again and again in terms of that it can't just be training that's the problem. Listeners are sending us a lot of feedback on that. So I will fold it in here because GQ Lewis on Twitter says, if police training were the issue, then why are so many white armed mass murderers brought in peacefully and so many unarmed black citizens killed? We talked about that a little bit ago, but Seth Stoughton, in the context of what you just said, does racism further exacerbate, further inflame the problems and the probability of a bad outcome?
Absolutely, I don't think there's any reasonable doubt about that. And, you know, we have to remember, at least in my opinion, we have problems with race, not just individuals who are consciously racist, but we have problems with implicit bias and associations that lead us, all of us, to interpret the world around us in particular ways. We have a black crime bias or a black suspicion bias that can lead us to conclude that particularly a young black man who's doing exactly the same thing in exactly the same circumstances as, say, an older white woman is nevertheless more suspicious. There was a study a couple of years ago that found that people tend to exaggerate the size of black men when they're asked to estimate how physically large they are. And of course, there is a correlation between someone's perceived size and how threatening they appear. These are not problems that are restricted to policing. We have to remember that policing is part of society, and it reflects, and in many cases, it magnifies all of the problems, including the problems with race, that we have in the society that officers operate in.
Well, let's go to a quick caller here. We're talking about police training this hour. It's one piece of the complex puzzle of policing in America. And if you... are a current or former law enforcement officer, or if you are a member of any group that looks at criminal justice, how can we improve police training? What would you change? Let's quickly go to Tom, who's calling from Scarborough, Maine. Tom, you're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have two general points and would like to hear Professor Stoughton's response. The first one is an idea that the fear-based is a quote that the evil that we fear becomes a certainty by what we do. And what we do is we tend to hire police officers who have a background in the military rather than in social work. So, and that's a local control decision that could be done by people's involvement. Black Lives Matter people can go to their local town and affect who gets hired. And if you're not hiring people that have a skill set that's very aggressive and that's also command control. Many shootings of people are involved with a failure for the suspect to understand and be able to respond to the commands of a police officer because of mental illness, because of language problems, because of decompensation and psychoses, a number of things. And when the officer gives a command and they're not compliant, that is an escalation immediately. That's not the paradigm that in the bad term of defunding the police, but a better term is conserving the police and using those resources very specifically, but allowing someone to de-escalate.
Right, and Tom, yeah, Tom, and we'll take a look at that. But your other point you wanted to make?
The other one is that the training in all American academies is shoot to kill. In other words, when they're allowed to use deadly force, they don't have in their own minds, although they do under the law, the ability to disable. So if you have someone with a knife 12 feet away, in Europe, they're allowed to use discretionary deadly force in order to disable. In America, it's anathema. It's not taught in the academies, and it's not discussed at all. So out of the 1,000 shootings that you have, there are more than half of them are situations where they could use disabling deadly force instead of terminus deadly force.
Yeah.
And they get trained only scant time dealing with mental illness, 12 to 14 hours where I am, and they get 150 hours in firearm training.
So Tom, just so you seem to know what the police training protocol in Scarborough, Maine is pretty well. I think you told our phone screener that you are a court-appointed defense attorney, and have you been in police academies to assist with training?
Yes.
And what happened?
Numerous times.
What happened?
It depends on the forum. The academies are all good because the professors want discussion. But when you lecture to police chiefs, you get shoes thrown at me, you know?
Say that again? When you talk to police chiefs?
Oh, they throw their shoes at me.
Like,
because I bring litigation against police for shooting wrongfully. And
oh,
it's very
I see.
Difficult.
Okay.
With the qualified immunity. It's very difficult.
I see. As a court-appointed attorney. I got it. Tom, thank you so much for your call there. So, Seth, there's a lot to dig through. I'm not sure we can get to it all. But first of all, talk to me about Tom's observation about the shoot-to-kill mentality.
Yeah, it's a really good observation. It's not the terminology that you hear in American policing. What you hear is shoot to stop the threat. But he is correct about the point of aim. Officers are taught that they should fire when they use a firearm. They should aim at center mass, that is the torso, and particularly the upper portion of the torso, because that is going to be the most effective way. They are taught to stop the threat. There is very strong cultural resistance in policing to using firearms in other ways, shooting at the upper legs, for example, which is trained in some other countries. That suggestion that officers do that is typically greeted with derision in American policing circles. I concede he is accurate when he says that, although they do not use policing in the United States tends not to use the phrase shoot to kill.
Seth, I'm going to bring in another guest here in just a second, but I've got to ask you. It's met with derision, the idea that shooting to the upper leg. Why the derision?
Because it's perceived as a completely unrealistic expectation. The legs are smaller than the torso is. Someone who's shot in the leg can still present a threat with whatever they happen to have in their hands. The perception in policing is that the idea of shooting an extremity is based on completely unrealistic expectations about what officers can do in a deadly force situation. And what's so shocking and kind of disappointing about that is we aren't, as an American institution, policing isn't learning the lessons that we could learn from some of our peer countries in Europe, for example.
Well, Seth Stoughton, stand by for just a moment, because I now want to bring in Jamiles Lardy. He joins us from New Orleans. He's staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Jamiles, welcome back to the program.
Hi, Megan. Nice to be with you.
So thank you for your patience there, Jamiles. I mean, we're talking about training in this hour, but of course, I mean, already you heard in our conversation with Seth that issues of law enforcement culture flow through all of this. And you've just done quite a bit of reporting on this. So talk to me a little bit about it. Like, where do you begin to start to answer the question about why these things happen?
Yeah, so we were really setting out to answer this this essential question that I think a lot of people had watching the George Floyd video, and have a question that people have almost any time that they see a rough arrest happen, right? Which is, why do the police act and behave in ways that to the general public seem brutal or harsh or mean-spirited or seem to have very little regard for the person's physical health or safety. And what we found in speaking to expert witnesses who defend cops when they're accused of excessive force, to police defense attorneys, to civil rights attorneys who take them on in court, and to experts generally, is that there's kind of a two-part reality here. The first is that understandably, priority one for most officers is that they go home safely at the end of their shift. That comes from, you know, certainly a matter of just human nature, but also what they're taught in the academy and what's preached by their unions. And that's all well and good. And we should all hope to have superiors in our lives who kind of see our own safety as a priority. But there is, as Seth mentioned, this hypervigilance that is preached. And it sort of goes along with a culture of domination and kind of an alpha mentality. So think about that. Let's break it down. You're telling officers, go out, dominate, be the alpha, take charge of situations, get control of them quickly. Well, what we know is that when you approach people in that way, mm-hmm. it's likely to elicit a reaction, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes that might be fear or uncertainty or panic, or people may flee. They may even have an outburst of violence when they're sort of when they're presented with that kind of domination energy. Okay, so you're a cop, and now that's happened, right? You went out into a situation, you were assertive, and a person is now reacting to that negatively. But the most important thing that you that you've been taught is that you go home at night. So by any means necessary, control this unpredictable threat. Well, doesn't that sound like a recipe for the use of force and for violence? And so the second piece comes when you factor in into that kind of neutral strategic dominance that just says, okay, this is about getting control of a situation. And you know, there's a more personal, personality-born dominance where some number of officers, and it's hard to say what the prevalence of this is, will take personally being questioned or being pushed back against and feel the need to essentially mete out justice as punishment for that. Yeah. So whether it's driven primarily by the former or the latter, I think the takeaway here is that if you resist arrest or act at all unpredictably during an arrest as the officer mm-hmm. perceives it, there's a mentality which says you need to be dealt with quickly and thoroughly.
Well, we'll be right back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered, but we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour about police training. And I'm joined today by Seth Stoughton. He's a law professor at the University of South Carolina and a former police officer who served in Tallahassee, Florida. He's also co-author of the book Evaluating Police Uses of Force. Jamiles Larte also joins us. He is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers the criminal justice system. And he's reported extensively on law enforcement culture. Now, Seth, I want to have you respond to what Jamiles was saying, telling us before the break here. But in order to do that, if you both could, I want to play a little bit of tape that we got from another former police officer when talking about this issue of training and culture. Calfonte Touré is a professor now of criminal justice at Quinnipiac University. He's also a senior fellow at Yale's Urban Ethnography Project. And he, in the early 2000s, was a police officer in Georgia, including a stint in Fulton County, Georgia, where Rayshard Brooks was killed earlier this month. And Touré told us that he joined the force because he knew how harmful policing could be to the black community, and he wanted to be a part of some positive change there. But first thing he told us is that that decision came with some challenges.
Once I joined the Blue Fraternity, I became an outsider to my community, because how could you possibly join law enforcement knowing the history and witnessing it and experiencing it, right? What law enforcement has been known or accused of doing in my community. So I was an outsider in two ways. I was too blue for the black community and too black for the blue uniform.
And Touré also told us that while he was being trained as a new officer, he sometimes questioned the dominant culture of policing, but that questioning was rarely welcomed.
I remember one time in Fulton County Police Academy in my class, one time I questioned the association with criminality, always visually, with the images of African Americans. And I remember not just the instructor sort of staring me down, but all my fellow cohort members turning back in their seats and just sort of giving me the eye.
Now, Touré also ascribes the behaviors that he saw in law enforcement as what he calls, he's phrasing it as, quote, blue fragility. And he talks about defensive strategies that police deploy against challenges to their or perceived challenges to their authority. And Jamiles, you were talking about that a couple of minutes ago. But Ture told us that not going along with that line of thinking in his experience, say, if you had an officer partner handcuff a suspect inappropriately, that not going along with that could come at a high cost.
Think about it this way. You go in a stop, the stop goes bad, and somebody pulls out a gun and begins to fire away. You want a backup officer that's going to help protect you. But if you run afoul of the culture of policing, if you've indicated that you will not sort of abide by blue fragility, if you, in essence, situate yourself outside of the fraternity, then you can't rely on that officer to protect your life.
That's Kalfani Ture, a professor of criminal justice at Quinnipiac University and a former law enforcement officer in Georgia. Seth, did you want to respond to what he was saying there? Because Ture's he's really bringing together these issues of training and culture.
Yeah, and both Ture and Jamiles are making really good points here. There is a very, very strong cultural imperative in policing to support and protect other officers, not just physically, but also from criticism, and particularly from external criticism. And part of supporting and protecting your other officers is a reluctance to be the one criticizing either other officers specifically or policing more generally. The idea of officers under threat, not just physically, but also from social forces like police reform, for example, is a pervasive aspect of what drives cultural insularity in policing. And it also contributes to the point Jamiles was making. There's this concept in policing that's referred to as command presence. And that's kind of nebulous, but it is often used to teach officers that they need to establish themselves as the unquestioned authority in any scene that they happen to be on, that they need to be in charge, they need to be seen as in charge, and any challenge to their authority could be a predictor or a predecessor to physical threat. So they need to, or at least they often do, view challenges to their authority as physical threats.
Well, Seth, if I can, then taken to its logical extreme, though, any behavior by the person being stopped, short of total supplication, again, at its logical extreme, could be considered a challenge to the authority, right?
That's exactly right. And one of the things that Jamiles is pointing out and that I've written on in an academic article is that attitude, that adversarial and hypervigilant approach, really creates avoidable conflict, because the officer comes in sometimes with a command presence, domineering attitude that demands compliance. And we as human beings do not like being forced to comply. So sometimes we push back. And when that pushback is interpreted as a challenge and a threat, we have set the stage for an entirely avoidable, in many cases, use of physical force.
Mm. Well, Jamiles, you spend a lot of time talking with criminal justice experts, with chiefs of police. What did you learn about how people are thinking of ways to begin to change this?
Yeah, so it's an interesting question, right? I mean, let's look at a couple of cities that have experienced a lot of turmoil recently. We have Minneapolis, where several years ago their chief Jean Harteau was a progressive reformist chief by any objective measure. She invited the DOJ into that department to make recommendations. That was before even the Ferguson and Black Lives Matter moment had taken hold. And she was either fired or asked to resign, left that department after the fatal shooting of Justine Damon. More recently in Atlanta, there was Chief Erica Shields, who you may remember was out among the protests, hugging protesters, describing the behavior of some of her officers as unacceptable, and was widely in police circles, as far as I know, considered kind of a reformer rock star. And Chief Shields resigned after the Brooks shooting that we were discussing earlier in the program. And so, you know, the question you asked is, how are folks trying to change departments? Mm. And I think one of the obvious answers that people will point to is leadership, right? I mean, anytime you're trying to change an organization, people point to leadership. But the question has to become at some point, and in no particular order, can a chief of a big city actually end all of the flashpoint fatal encounters? Who would they have to be, and what would they have to be embracing, if not folks like Jean Harteau and Erica Shields, mm-hmm. to make those kinds of changes? And there may be actual answers to that question, right? Maybe they've said the right things and have been ineffectual behind the scenes. That's possible, and it certainly happens in public policy sometimes. But I would wager, and based on the reporting that we've done so far, that it has more to do with these kind of cleaves that most industries have between management and rank and file. And the people doing the actual work have a culture and a set of experiences that they're sort of familiar with, and a range that they're operating in. And it's very difficult to take control of a large organization and change all of that, especially when those folks are well organized. And it kind of brings you to the observation, I don't know who first made it, that culture eats policy for breakfast. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how you address that is hard to say. I mean, one idea we heard from reporting this most recent story was from a sheriff who suggested agencies should hand out de-escalation awards and kind of tap young cops to serve as ambassadors for this guardian style policing, right? This less confrontational, warrior mentality policing. And said, you know, you would develop groupthink, like you'd change the culture. But one of the things experts have warned us as we've been looking into this is that, you know, de-escalation and a lot of other buzzword trainings are not an easy fix for ingrained patterns of behavior.
Right.
So police administrators need to, I mean, think about it. If you've ever had a job, you've probably had trainings as a part of that job, things that you were required to sit through and learn and maybe complete a module to show that you'd taken it in. And there are some trainings that people find more interesting and some trainings that people find less interesting. And so if the overall culture in a department or if the sort of from a personality standpoint, the type of people you're attracting to a field are people who want to shoot guns and drive fast, or, you know, like think action movie stuff, then sitting down for, you know, several hours of de-escalation training is not necessarily going to change how you approach your work. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that all police departments are just made up of those folks. I'm saying that we have increasingly over the last 20 years made policing more and more military styled. We've recruited people with these flashy videos of kind of grand displays of using force and cool looking military style equipment. And so those are in large part the people who you've attracted to the profession. And that's, you know, it's not as easy as sitting people in a community college hall for 8 or 12 or 16 hours, and then all of a sudden they learn how to de-escalate, yeah, if that's not why they became an officer in the first place.
Well, I want to, on this point, I just want to get one last call in here. Pat is calling from Bradenton, Florida. Pat, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing? First of all, the last gentleman was absolutely right. I was a taser training instructor in Northern California. I'm a retired police officer now. And all the trainings that I've been to, it's like leading a horse to water. You just can't make them drink if they don't want to. Hmm. Some of these police officers are totally into it. Other ones are like, I'm just going because I need to check that box off this month. That's one of the issues that I've, you know, come across. The other one I wanted to go back a while ago, talking about fear-based mm-hmm. training. I went to Academy in 2002. Our fear base was, you're going to get sued. If you let that guy go and walk home and you know he's drunk, he could get hit by a car and you're going to get sued. If you don't do something, you're going to get sued. If you do do something, you're going to get sued. So all these things, you've got to look at what you're doing and what the perception is. So training is great if people are taking it in.
Right. Well, Pat, thank you so much for that call. And just on that last thing that, that Pat said about being sued, we got a Facebook comment from Don from Sheboygan, who says, Don says he's a former cop, and he says, we used to be able to give people rides home if they were intoxicated, but because society has become more litigious, I can be sued if I turn someone loose and they end up back behind the wheel again. So that's yet another piece of this picture here, which we won't be able to do justice to this hour, but wanted to acknowledge that. Seth and Jamiles, in the last couple of minutes that we have, I want to come back to, yes, that training is just a part of a bigger part of the picture. It's a part of the bigger picture, and the complex picture. And that people over and over again asked, are we entirely missing the point here? Because policymakers frequently go to training as something that we can, like a technical fix to a cultural problem. But, you know, could we've made adjustments to training before at the state level and local level. But yet, you know, I keep thinking of Dylann Roof when he shot members of a church in cold blood when he was arrested. There was no violent interaction there with the cops. They even took him to have burgers before they brought him in. I mean, what amount of training would change that versus how other people are treated? I mean, are we actually missing the point here, Seth?
I think you said it really well, that we're talking about a very small piece of what has to be a much bigger conversation. Training is essential. It is part of improving policing and getting it to be where it should be. But if that's the primary focus, let alone the exclusive to see the improvements that we need. George Floyd, the arrest and death of George Floyd is a perfect example. Those officers were not doing what they were trained to do. If anything, they were doing what they were trained to not do. Training was not the driving factor in that particular case. And while we shouldn't use one particular case to make a broad comment, I think Jamiles is absolutely correct. And when he focuses on the need for deeper cultural change, training has to be part of that, not just what we're training officers to do, but also how we're training them. You know, Jamiles mentioned sitting in a classroom for a lecture on de-escalation. Mm-hmm. Well, de-escalation is a skill. So if officers aren't learning and practicing that skill in a dynamic, interactive scenario, then the training is more for public relations than it is to actually improve behaviors. And when we teach officers, the implied message of training like that is that this doesn't matter very much. So if we want to shift police culture, we need to do it very deliberately. And we can do that in part through training, but we should not be looking exclusively or even primarily at training as a cure-all or even as a significant part of the overarching changes that need to be made.
Well, Seth Stoughton, law professor at the University of South Carolina and a former police officer who served in Tallahassee, Florida, co-author of the book Evaluating Police Uses of Force. Seth, thank you so much for joining us today. And Jamiles Larte, staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit news organization that covers the American criminal justice system. We have links to Jamiles' reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Jamiles, thanks to you as well. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.